Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
Hello, this is international Catholic singer Anna Nuzzo, inviting you to join me and Father Dan Cambra of the Marian Fathers on a select international tour's Divine Mercy pilgrimage to Poland and the Czech Republic. It takes place in September of 2019, and we would love for you to join us. For more information, go to my website, annanuzzo.com. Thank you, and God bless.
Do you wish you knew the saints better? Overwhelmed with all the events in Catholic history and just wish you could tie it all together? It's tough work, and even scientists have determined that it takes approximately 400 repetitions to create a new synapse in the brain, unless it is done with play, in which case it takes between 10 and 20 repetitions. Introducing Saint Cards, where the facts about saints and history are presented in fun and engaging games for ages 4 to 104. Check out Saint Cards at saintcards.com and begin the fun for your family, school, and parish today.
Introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger. Today we have with us Steve Weidenkopf. He's a lecturer in church history at the Christendom College Graduate School of Christendom College in Alexandria, Virginia. He has given numerous presentations and seminars on church history, marriage and family life, human sexuality, and theology throughout the U.S. and Canada. He served as the director of the Office of Marriage and Family Life for the Archdiocese of Denver and as an advisor to Archbishop Charles Chaput and was an instructor at the Our Lady of the New Advent Catechetical Institute. Today, we'll be discussing his book from our Sunday visitor, Timeless, A History of the Catholic Church. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Thanks, Pete, for having me on. I'm very happy to be here.
All right. So let's dive in. Great book, and we're going to get into the details of it today, but what brought you to write Timeless?
Yeah, well, you know, I noticed that there was there's a need through my teaching, you know, the last 12 years or so, I noticed that there was a definite need for a one-volume narrative, you know, history of the church. I mean, there hasn't really been one published in a number of years, and not one, at least, I thought that was, you know, comprehensive enough that could be utilized in a classroom, for example, or just would give people enough, you know, detailed information about the church's history and to tell that story in kind of, you know, good detail. So, you know, a lot of the one volume good histories of the church were published in English and many in translation actually in the earlier in the 20th century in the 60s and 50s and stuff. And so there hasn't really been a good one, I thought, since then. So I wanted to be able to you know, offer this and kind of, you know, take the fruit of my teaching over these last numbers of years and what I've been able to uncover in my own research and be able to present that to a wider audience.
Mm-hmm. You know, the one thing I found engaging and interesting about the book is through the years of reviewing books, I've encountered a number of these history books, but this one I felt was very approachable, and it didn't feel like a textbook to me. It's approachable for the average reader as well, I believe.
Oh, that's great. That was definitely one focus that I wanted to get across, is to make sure that anybody could pick this up. I mean, I wanted the, you know, person in the pew, so to speak, to you know, the Catholic who, you know, has at least some level of interest in history, or maybe not even a whole lot of interest in history. Maybe been, you know, somewhat hesitant to pick up a church history book in the past because of what you just said, that maybe it's too dry or too academic, mm-hmm. or too much like a textbook, but wanted to make something that was definitely accessible to tell the great story of our church, because there are a lot of, neat little stories about our church. It is, as I try to paint it in the book, is you know, our family history that's full of, you know, drama and tension and comedy even, and just, again, give that to a much wider audience than heretofore.
So, as you just alluded to, there's a lot to the history of the church. What was your focus in this one volume book, and what is the timeline of the book? What all does it cover?
Yeah, sure. So I cover the 2,000-year history of the church. I start with what traditionally is known as the birthday of the church, you know, from a temporal perspective, and that's the Feast of Pentecost, right, when the Holy Spirit comes to the Blessed Mother and the apostles in Jerusalem, and the, you know, the church begins to spread as the apostles preach the good news. So I start there and then go through all 2,000 years of the church's history, ending in the modern world, you know, with the pontificate of Pope Francis. But I don't spend a whole lot of time, really, on the modern era of the church. I spent a good portion of time all the way up until, you know, the later 20th century, to the pontificate of John Paul II, primarily because, you know, the readers, people are going to pick up this book, have all lived through, or most of them at least have lived through the pontificate of John Paul II and obviously Benedict and Francis. And so those you know, events are fresh in everyone's minds and not really the, you know, the subject of this particular book. So I wanted to focus on those previous centuries, really, in church history. And as I point out, you know, in my introduction to the book, is that, you know, the general kind of main theater of action, so to speak, in the book, it centers on Europe and, you know, the Mediterranean, North Africa. And that's not to, you know, somehow lessen the impact of other areas of the world and the church in those areas, but the necessity of having to really, you know, kind of pick one main area and focus on those actions. And, you know, I focus on the church in Europe primarily because, you know, the church was obviously a huge influence in the development of European civilization and Western civilization as a whole. You know, it helps, you know, the life of the church in that corner of the world actually obviously influenced the life of the church in other areas of the world too, especially through missionary efforts all throughout the church's history. But, you know, obviously, particularly with the discovery of the New World, and missionary efforts here, as well as in the Far East and whatnot. So that's kind of the limiting aspect to the book. So I don't really get into a whole lot of, you know, Eastern Orthodox history or, you know, Eastern Catholic rites history either. It's principally a book that focuses on Christendom, on Western Europe, and the, you know, the Latin rite of the church.
Okay. We kind of brushed on this a little bit, but I'd like to bring this point up again. Who did you write Timeless for? Who's your target audience?
Yeah, the audience is really everybody. I mean, every Catholic, the person in the pew. I wanted to make the book accessible to everybody, not just, you know, students or you know, whether undergrad or graduate or high school students. Although I do think the book could be used, and you know, I know it is being used in certain areas or in certain schools, rather, as a textbook, you know, for high school or college level even. But that's not the main, you know, intent. I mean, the intent was to make it accessible to the average person and to make it detailed so that, you know, the average person can just read it. And I tried to present it as a story, as a narrative, which makes it engaging. But also, too, for those who are maybe a little bit more serious or maybe have a little bit more interest in church history, a little bit more knowledge in the area as well. I, you know, heavily cite my sources throughout the book. So there's a number of, you know, several hundred footnotes, several pages of a bibliography as well. So those who want to pursue more, you know, more research in a particular area or kind of question maybe, well, where did Steve come up with this particular idea or that particular statistic or thought, then you can research that on your own as well.
So what entailed the writing of this book? What research, how long did it take? Because it's certainly an ambitious project. And so that people understand what we're discussing here, the book, without the rather large bibliography you included, comes to 538 pages long.
Yeah, it's a long book, and you know, as we've talked about, I tried to make it engaging and also to organize it such that it doesn't seem so overwhelming when you pick it up. I thought our Sunday Visitor, frankly, did a great job in the layout of the book and in the font and how it feels in your hand, because it is a big book, but it doesn't feel like it's overwhelmingly, you know, too cumbersome or burdensome. And as I mentioned, you know, I tried to structure it so that each chapter, there's kind of, you know, sub parts to each chapter so that you can go from one section to the next and, you know, read a little bit of it at a time, read one section to another section and then put the book down and come back to it if you want. So it's not something that has to be continuously, you know, read, you know, or you have to be really engaged or focused on for long periods of time. So I didn't want people to kind of get, you know, intimidated by the book. But to answer your question in terms of, you know, how I came about writing it or what research and things that I use. So, I mean, this book really is, frankly, the fruit of the 12 years of me teaching here at the graduate school at Christendom College. And so it's a lot of it is my notes, you know, my lecture notes over those 12 years or so, and the books that I have read in various areas and the research of others that I've utilized, you know, some primary sources, obviously, as well in translation. You know, a very big help to me, obviously, in my class, as well as just this book as a whole, is Warren Carroll's 6-volume History of Christendom series, which really is for, you know, the specialist or the scholar or those who are really, really interested, because each one of his volumes are, you know, 600, 700 pages, multiple footnotes and bibliographies, and so very, very, very detailed. But I relied a lot on obviously, that is kind of a main focus, main narrative. But other sources as well, all in the bibliography there, some from Catholic sources, some non-Catholic sources, obviously. And where appropriate, you know, I tried to rely on primary sources as well, letters of popes and things like that, and early Christian documents and the writings of you know, the church fathers and what have you, to tell the story of the church in those ages.
Mm-hmm. You talk about this in the introduction, and I'd like to have you share some of this thought process with today. There's history, and then you talk about Catholic understanding of history. What is the Catholic understanding of history?
Yeah, sure. Most people, I think, are kind of, you know, taking it back to realize that there's a Catholic understanding of history. How could we possibly talk about that? Well, really, when we approach the subject of history as Catholics, there's a few things we have to keep in mind in terms of, you know, again, that we view it a little bit differently than, say, a secular historian will. Or even, you know, the ancient Greek and Roman historians looked at history. And this kind of try to point out in the book is that, you know, Greek and Roman historians really saw history as a series of repetitive cycles, right? Never-ending cycles. There really was no beginning to history. There's no real end to history. There's no real purpose even to history as well. But a Catholic, especially through the writings of St. Augustine, we come to realize, or we know, that history is not that, right? It's not just a series of never-ending repetitive cycles. It does have a beginning. You know, human history began, right, in the beginning when God created ex nihilo, out of nothing. Human history will have an end when Christ comes again and ushers in, you know, a new heaven and a new earth. And we know that there's a central event, you know, to human history. The most important event of all of human history was the incarnation, the coming of the God-man. And that action, you know, radiates forwards and backwards in time. And so there is this linear progression that we see in history as Catholics that, you know, we're not marching just kind of aimlessly off into the distance in the future to nothing. You know, we're marching towards the end of time when Christ will come again. And so that should shape how we see the activity of human beings in the world, you know, both present or past as well as present. And hopefully with that in mind will help us to obviously shape the future in a way that's much more in keeping with the gospel.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll come back to talk more about Timeless. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media.
The Bible is filled with surprises. Father William L. Burton, OFM, doesn't want you to be intimidated by studying the Bible. In fact, as a scripture scholar, he believes reading God's Word is not only educational, but also fun and entertaining. In Abba, Isn't Daddy, and Other Biblical Surprises, What Catholics Really Need to Know About Scripture Study, Burton explores a number of fascinating facts that help you become more familiar with the Bible, scripture study, and your Catholic faith. Check out Abba, Isn't Daddy, and Other Biblical Surprises at AveMariaPress.com. Or look for it wherever books and ebooks are sold.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. With us today, we have Steve Weidenkopf, the author of Timeless, A History of the Catholic Church. And we left off last segment, Steve, talking about the Catholic understanding of history. And history to us, to Catholics, is much more than simply recorded events. What role does salvation play in the big picture of history, and why is it important we pay attention to it when we're studying history?
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, salvation history obviously is, you know, is wrapped up in human history. It is really, you know, recognizing the salvific actions of Christ, his passion, death, and resurrection really helps, really, frankly, to make history understandable, right? To put a meaning or a purpose to human history. I mean, the Catechism even says, right, that Christ is the meaning and the foundation of human history. And so really any study of human history cannot ignore the salvific actions of Christ and the fact that, you know, he established a church and gave her that mission, right, to continue his salvific mission, to spread his gospel and to be the instrument of salvation in the world until he comes again. So very, very important to keep that in mind as we study church history and to see, you know, the important aspect of the fact that God is involved in human history. You know, we're not deists. We don't believe that God just created, you know, the planet and created human beings and then just kind of set it in motion. And he's off in his, you know, lazy boy, just kind of reclining and, you know, watching humorously what we do here on Earth. And he is, you know, actively involved in human history. And there are certain historical events where you can see that clearly. You know, one that I talk about in the book in the early part of the church's history is with the whole arrival of Constantine, you know, the Roman general initially on the scene as he and his troops are marching through Gaul, and they see a miraculous vision of a cross in the sky. And, you know, that, you know, changes his perspective on this battle that he's about ready to enter into. And the fact that he wins the battle, he attributes to this vision and to the Christian God and begins to favor, you know, the Catholic Church and even becomes a catechumen and eventually would be baptized before he dies. So, you know, radically altering the history of the Roman Empire as well as the history of the church, and all because, you know, God intervenes in human history and has a role to play. So, again, we have to keep that in mind when we study church history, or any history, frankly, because it is extremely important and vital.
So why, a more general, maybe 10,000-foot view of this, why is it important for us to study church history at all?
Yeah, there's, you know, I enumerate a number of reasons in the book, really, in my introduction, about why we should study church history, because that's a good question. I mean, a lot of people ask that, right? You know, there's a limited amount of time, you know, in our busy lives, and, you know, there's always Bible studies at church, or there should be, and many parishes have Bible studies, and, you know, or maybe we should study the catechism or doctrines of the church, so why take our time and study church history, you know, especially, it's happened in the past, so why focus on it? I try to enumerate four main reasons why we should study church history. I mean, one we touched on briefly here a little bit ago before the break was, you know, that making sense of, we can't really understand the present unless we understand the past, right? Mm-hmm. How things are in the world today and, you know, their actions, the interaction between various religious groups, the interaction between various nation states, even, you know, none of that can be understood in the modern world, in today's world, without an understanding and a focus and appreciation for history. So that's one. And then obviously understanding that our history helps us understand the present, but then we can shape better the future as well. You know, another reason why we study church history is to grow deeper in our knowledge of Christ. You know, the whole reason to do any kind of study, frankly, in with our faith, whether it's doctrine or scripture or church history, is so that we grow deeper in our love for Christ. And as I mentioned earlier, he is the foundation and center of all of human history. So by studying history and specifically his mystical body, the church, we do grow deeper, or we should grow deeper in our relationship with him. You know, another reason why we should study the church is, or church history, is so that we can help defend the faith, right? Defend the church when she's attacked. We have so many examples in the modern world of people utilizing the church's historical events, or many of them, the biggest ones being the Crusade and Inquisition, but there are others, and trying to use those historical events and attack the church and attack the faith because of these historical events. And really, it's more often than not, it's a false historical presentation or false presentation of those historical events. And if we don't know our history, then we as Catholics can't defend the faith. And we're apt to believe, right? We're apt to believe what people say about the church that is false. So we need to study for that reason. And then fourthly, you know, we study church history because of, you know, our Catholic identity. You know, what I try to bring out in the beginning of the book and the introduction is understanding church history in a new way and seeing it as, you know, the church is our family, and those who have come before us, the men and women who have come before us, they are our brothers and sisters in the Lord as part of this unique and beautiful family. And so just as we would go study our own family history, you know, why, you know, who are the Weidenkopfs, where did they come from, why did they come to the United States, you know, some fun stories about, you know, my relatives. So too, that's what we're really doing when we study church histories. We're looking at our spiritual genealogy, and we can't really know who we are as Catholics unless we know where we've come from and who the members of our family are.
So to pause here a little bit, I think it's safe to say that the large majority of Catholics, unless of course they went to Catholic school, have learned history from a secular point of view. They've studied a timeline in school or else or watched it on TV or somehow that either completely scrubbed church history from that timeline or has skewed it to an anti-Catholic stance. Why do you think this has happened?
Yeah, that's a great question. And not only, I mean, I agree with that, not only do I think it's from a secular perspective, but even more so, I think whenever you do have religious events or even the church talks about in, you know, modern textbooks, has a lot to do with an English Protestant perspective. So most of our history in the English-speaking world has been presented through this English Protestant lens. Mm-hmm. And primarily because, frankly, it's, you know, we're our nation was founded mostly by Englishmen, and so with that history of England and various, you know, English political aspects as well. So that's one reason. And, you know, frankly, in England, Protestantism succeeded and remained entrenched, whereas the Catholic faith was unfortunately kind of swept aside, and the church was kicked out of England in many ways. So, you know, I think that's the major reason why you have that. And that's one reason. But then follow along a little bit further in history, when you get to the period of the Enlightenment in the 17th century and 18th century in France and England, you still have writers who are very, very anti-religion. They're anti-church in particular, and they wanted to decrease the church's influence in society and in the public sphere. And so they create a lot of false narratives and false myths about the church's historical events in order to, again, to reduce the church's influence in society. So it's kind of a combination of, you know, this kind of English Protestant narrative that is the main narrative we get in most of our books in the English world. Mm-hmm. And then the Enlightenment, you know, anti-Catholic, anti-faith authors that try to downplay the importance of the supernatural, downplay the importance of the church and her role in society at best, and at worst, try to illustrate that the church was, you know, was full of a bunch of, you know, greedy and barbaric and, mm-hmm. and horrible people.
So the million-dollar question and the follow-up to that is, how do we fix that?
Well, one way in which to do that is to know our authentic history, right? To make sure that we utilize good sources, that we study, you know, our faith. Well, first of all, you know, we have to study our church's history. I mean, so many people, you know, do not study the church's history because, again, you know, it's not their own fault. I'm not blaming people. In many ways, history can be presented in a very boring, very dry, very scholarly kind of way. That's why, again, I wrote Timeless in a way that was hopefully as a story and is engaging. And mm-hmm. And one aspect of that is, and I touched on it briefly in the book, is that, you know, history up until the 19th century really was seen, when it was taught in schools and universities, was seen as a form of literature. It was the telling of one nation or one people's story. And so it was very engaging, right? Because you have all kinds of things of the elements of a great story, you know, drama, heroes, villains, comedy, all these things. And then in the 19th century, things begin to change a bit when you have some Northern Protestant German scholars who begin to look at history as a more, objective science kind of thing. And so they bring a little bit more different focus to the study of history. And again, some of which they did was not bad in terms of looking at source documents and primary sources and trying to, you know, look at the differences between various manuscripts, for example, of various things and different authors and some criticism of those texts. And nothing wrong with that. But it has had a tendency to, boring, you know, or make history a bit more boring than it needs to be. So I think we need to reengage how we write history, first of all, how historians view the subject and how they present the subject to others. There's a way to write, you know, for people within the academy when you're trying to present some kind of story or some kind of textual criticism. But then there's a way to write for a popular audience that, is more engaging. So that's one way to do it. Another way, again, for the Catholic is to make sure that you study, you know, and read good Catholic authors who are open with their sources and, you know, who don't whitewash the church's history. You don't want to read something that's triumphalistic, that's just, you know, the church never did anything bad or no one mm-hmm. in the church ever did anything bad, to be more specific. And so you have to, and I try to present that in Timeless as well. I mean, it is, you know, I'm very open with my approach. This is, I'm a Catholic historian. Practicing faith-believing Catholic, and I'm approaching the subject from that perspective. However, you know, that doesn't mean that I just write from a triumphalistic perspective, right? I'm making sure to illustrate that there were problems in the church's history in the past, and you know, we had some people who didn't live up in accord, live in accordance with their vocation, and some bad leaders and things like that. But always try to present those events in a historical, proper historical context as well. But so, you know, again, it's a focus, I think, on number one, we have to study. We have to study authentic history. We have to recognize the viewpoint of historians of the books that we read and why they're writing these particular books, especially when it comes to secular books or books that might be presenting a more English Protestant perspective to church history. And then also to historians, it's on the historical community to write more engaging and powerfully, important works.
So you talk about this a bit in the introduction, and I'd like you to share with us today. What do you feel is the best method of learning church history?
Yeah, the best learning of learning, or the best method rather of learning church history is as you know, kind of what we've been talking about, is just this is having it presented to us as a story, right? And it's not something that I just came up with myself, or you know, other historians in years past have written history that way because, you know, as I mentioned before, it was seen as literature, but it really comes from Christ himself, right? I mean, take the example of our Lord and how he taught, to his disciples, he was at times very direct, but to the larger crowds, to the bigger group of people, he told stories, right? He told parables. And why did he do that? Well, he did that because we remember stories, right? We're created to be people who appreciate narrative, people who appreciate stories. Everybody can think about it in their own lives, right? We all probably have the relative or the friend that we just love being around because they tell just fantastic stories, right? Or we like talking to our grandparents or people who are elderly who have, you know, stories to tell us about, you know, the war, the Second World War, for example, or the Great Depression or Vietnam or any other kind of major historical event that these people lived to be able to get their perspectives. We love movies, right, as a mm-hmm. culture. We love books, and we don't just read books and watch movies and kind of keep them to ourselves, right? We always want to share those things. Why? Why is that? Well, because, you know, we are created by God to be relational and to understand, you know, things through story. And so that's how Christ taught, and that's how I think it's important for us to learn church history, but also even more important for how church history should be taught. Because then it becomes much more engaging to us, not only engaging, but it becomes more identifiable, right? We actually begin to see the church's history as it is. It's our family history, as I mentioned, our spiritual genealogy. So that makes us want to know more. And not only does it make us want to know more, but even somewhat more importantly, it helps us remember what we have been taught. Because too many times, I think, for people, their impression of history or history class is, you know, a lot of names, a lot of dates, a lot of events. I studied all those so I could pass my test, you know, I passed my test and then I forgot everything I learned. Mm-hmm. And that happens because, again, the way that people, you know, most people have been taught history is not this engaging narrative way or to see it as a story that had any kind of meaning or identifiable meaning to their own lives. Instead, it was just, you know, names, dates, and events. Now, names, dates, and events obviously are very important in history. Can't really understand history without them, but that's not the sole focus or shouldn't be the sole focus of the study of the subject.
All right, with that, we're going to take another quick break. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media, and we'll be right back.
Are you married? I'd like to suggest that you often return to the fond and true memory of your spouse when you first met. And on your wedding day, well, he or she is still that same lovable person. Perhaps life has presented many challenges you did not expect back then, but you have come through these together. And the providential fire of your tribulations and your love has forged you into the one body you are today. And that is a beautiful thing. Never let anyone or any inferior thing tear you and your spouse asunder. God is one with you. He is love. Your marriage is love. And love endures whatever comes. It does not come to an end. See 1 Corinthians 13. I'm Jim Littleton of FormingFaithfulFamilies.com.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger. With us today, we have Steve Weidenkopf, the author of Timeless, A History of the Catholic Church. And Steve, you break the book up into 10 chapters, or essentially periods of church history. And I'd like to take a look at a few of those. as we wind down today so we can get a taste of what the book is about. And in chapter one, it's entitled The Beginning, Pentecost, and the Spread of the Gospel. How rapidly did the church grow during this period, and what challenges did the church face?
Yeah, I mean, the church grew, the faith spread rapidly, you know, throughout the early, throughout the Mediterranean world in its early days, primarily because, you know, the Roman Empire. This was a time in the empire of peace, relative peace, and so people were more apt to be open to, learning something new or to be focusing on some of these major questions in life, you know, why am I here, what's the meaning of life, these kinds of things. Which really just aren't a concern for people, for example, in the midst of a famine or plague or warfare or things like that. So that helped to contribute to the spread of the gospel. The infrastructure of the Roman Empire as well helped. A very extensive road system developed by the Roman army. And so, you had the Mediterranean and the supplies that went around, the commerce that was present in the empire as well, helped the faith and the early apostles and the early missionaries to be able to spread the faith throughout the known world at the time and even beyond the confines of it. And obviously, no discussion of the church's early history in that period of time can be complete without focusing on St. Paul and what he was able to do, being the apostle to the Gentiles and spreading the faith and to some of the major communities and cities throughout the Roman Empire. And obviously his writings formed the bulk of the New Testament. So this was a dynamic and engaging time in the life of the church, and the empire was kind of ripe for the spread of this gospel. And but obviously, when you come into contact with at the time the world's major superpower, there's going to be a reaction. And early in the church's history, especially in the city of Rome, there was a major negative reaction towards the Christians, as they were utilized as scapegoats by Nero for a major disaster that happened to the city of Rome in the year 64 when there was a big fire. So, from the very beginning, the church deals with, persecution, external persecution, as well as, the persecution that they had suffered in the hands of some of the early apostles and early martyrs had suffered, in the Holy Land with the Jews.
So you write about later in the book, a chapter called Bright Lights in a Dark Time. And during this period, we see the rise of Islam. When we talk about outside forces that impact the church, what impact did the rise of Islam eventually have on the Catholic Church?
Yeah, so ever since the, Muhammad began to present his teachings in the Arabian Peninsula, back in the 7th century, you have a constant source of conflict really between Islam and the Christian world and the church. It began because of the Muhammad's teachings, really, or at least one aspect of his teachings, which is that Muhammad saw the world as broken into two different camps. There was everybody who believed in Allah as God and Muhammad as the prophet, and they belonged to what's called the House of Islam, and then everyone else Muhammad termed the House of War. And so it was the job or the duty, the vocation of everybody in the House of Islam to bring those in the House of War into the community of Islam by violent force, if necessary, through jihad, that violent struggle. So these are the teachings of Muhammad. So from the very beginning of the origins of Islam, Islam was very expansionistic, was imperialistic and militaristic in its outlook towards the world. And so, soon after Muhammad's death in the year 632, Muslim forces, kind of spread out from the Arabian Peninsula. They conquer the holy city of Jerusalem in 638. They even get to the gates of Constantinople and besiege the city. Early in the middle part of the 7th century, they're eventually defeated from that, but they would return time and time again, eventually succeeding in conquering that city in the 15th century. Then they swept through all of North Africa, which was major Christian areas at the time. So you have Egypt, which was a major Christian province, was completely conquered, by the year 711. They've crossed the Straits of Gibraltar and gotten into modern-day Spain and Portugal and make even their way into France, only a 2.5-hour drive away from Paris, a place called Tours in the early 8th century. So they're beaten back by a Frankish army under the command of Charles Martel. So from the very beginning, Islam had been very, very militaristic and expansionistic and really changed their conquest of North Africa and into, again, modern-day Spain and Portugal, as well as the Holy Land, really altered the change of the Mediterranean and altered Europe's reliance really on the Mediterranean for commerce and for various things that they used, like papyrus, for example, kind of disappeared in Europe as a result of the Islamic conquests. And so instead you have the development of the use of vellum and of other means with which to write, to copy manuscripts and things. So the whole culture, the whole political orientation even of Europe changes as a result of the Islamic conquest. And obviously that has an impact on the church as well, and the spread of the gospel. Mm-hmm. And some areas that had, again, once been Christian for centuries, right, ceased to be Christian. And it took a bit of time for Islam as a whole for people within these Islamic occupied territories to actually become converts to Islam. It's contrary to popular belief, not every area of the Islamic conquest did they try to convert people by the sword. In many places, Christians and Jews were allowed to live under the Islamic authorities. However, their status was barely that above slaves, and there was heavy societal pressure to convert. And over time, over about 2.5 centuries, most of those areas that had once been heavily Christian became Muslim.
But again, it proves that the church can withstand virtually anything, and it has throughout its 2,000-year history.
Yes, very true. I mean, you still have, you know, indigenous Christians and Jews in those areas as well. And, you know, Christ said that he would always be with the church, and until he comes again, you know, nothing will defeat her or conquer her. So the faith continues and did continue, and so did the church.
So let's talk a bit about the Crusades. Opinions are mixed on them. So I was wondering, for us, what was the purpose? Were they necessary, and were they effective?
Sure. So I do talk about the Crusades, obviously, in a chapter in the book. I also wrote a specific book on the Crusades years ago called The Glory of the Crusades. It was published by Catholic Answers Press, where I look at some of the major modern myths about the Crusades and answer them with historical sources and authentic historical information. So, I mean, the Crusades ultimately were a response to this Islamic conquest that we just talked about. They come to the forefront of, you know, the church's life in the late 11th century when Blessed Pope Urban II, goes to a local meeting of French bishops in the city of Clermont in November of 1095 and preaches the First Crusade. And what he asked was for Christian warriors to utilize their military skill and their weapons to go to the Holy Land and to liberate the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, to liberate also then obviously the Holy City itself, Jerusalem, and place it back into the hands of Christians. And he did this. He called these crusaders to do that because there had been frequent attacks and harassment of indigenous Christians still living in the Holy Land, as well as Western Christian pilgrims leaving from Europe to go and visit the holy sites. And also, he had received a request from the Byzantine emperor for military aid because the province of Anatolia, which is at the time was called Anatolia, now it's modern-day Turkey, was conquered by the Turks and the subject Turks, and the emperor needed help in reconquering that and recovering that territory. So there was a lot going on at the end of the 11th century when the Crusades were ultimately called. But what Urban really did was he launched a movement. It ultimately would be a, you know, nearly 700-year movement in the life of the church and of Europe, where popes, all the way from Urban II to Innocent the Ninth, would call Christian warriors to go on crusade and to help to recover this ancient Christian territory that had been lost. And they provided, these popes provided spiritual incentives, including the indulgence for these warriors to do that. Ultimately, tradition, you know, most historians record that there were eight, you know, numbered crusades, we call them first through eight, to try to recover this Christian territory in North Africa as well as the Holy Land. Ultimately, that last eight numbered one ended in the end of the 11th century, or 13th century rather. And they were ultimately not successful. There was one that was fully successful. The First Crusade actually did accomplish what it set out to do, which was to liberate the Holy City of Jerusalem, which the Crusaders did do on July 15th of 1099. But most of the others were not successful. Some were partially successful, but for the most part, they didn't accomplish what they wanted to do, which was to recover this territory. Jerusalem was in the hands of Christians for about 88 years after the First Crusade. And there was some territory in what became known as the Latin East, which was populated by Christians and, you know, maintained and controlled and governed by Christians. But again, the last major Christian city in the Holy Land, called Acre, fell at the end of the 13th century. So after that, the crusading movement continues, but it changes its kind of focus and orientation. It becomes now in the, when you get to the 15th and really into the 16th century, it becomes a focus on defending the homeland, defending, you know, Christendom, really, Eastern Europe in particular, as well as Vienna, from the incursion of the Turks. And really, the crusading movement by the end of the 17th century pretty much ends because the geopolitical aspect of the world and of how secular rulers interacted with the church and how they interacted with the Pope in particular changed. And so it kind of peters out at the end there, at the, you know, at the end of the 17th century, really.
So we only briefly covered some of what the book contains, but at the very end of the book, you end up leaving readers with hope. And the end has already been written. We know the church will win. We know Christ will return. What is our role in all of this in the timeline of history?
Yeah, we have a very important role to play, and I appreciate you bringing that up as I highlight that at the end of the book, is that, you know, I want everyone to realize, who reads this book, to realize that, you know, you can sometimes we try to focus, you know, we read the lives of saints or we read, you know, church history and we look at all the great things that these men and women who come before us have done, and we think, wow, you know, that's, I'm no St. Francis or I'm no, you know, Jean de La Valette, for example, who, you know, defended Malta against the Turks in the 16th century, or, you know, I'm not one of these big crusaders or, you know, a great pope or anything like that. You know, I'm just a simple Catholic or whatever. But, you know, that's not how, you know, the Lord sees us, right? The Lord has created each one of us, right? He has called us to faith. Through baptism and through a life of grace and the sacraments in the church. And he has a very important role that he wants each and every one of us to play in our lives, you know, and some of us are called to play, you know, really big, you know, roles that influence, you know, history, you know, forever, or, you know, the life of a nation forever, whatever. But most of us are not called to do that, right? Most of us are called to just live the life that God has given to us, the gift that he's given to us, and influence the lives of those around us by how we live our faith, right? How we live the role that he has called us to play in the divine drama. So we all are called to be people of hope through our baptism. You know, we hope and we trust in the Lord and know that things, although they might seem bad or might seem, you know, discouraging in our lives or in the life of the church, to know that he, as you mentioned, will have the ultimate, he does have the ultimate victory, and that, you know, we're called to be faithful, not always successful, but definitely faithful servants of the Lord in helping to spread the gospel and to make the world a better place.
So you've written a number of books in addition to Timeless that deal with different areas of history or topics. What is your favorite period of church history and why?
Oh, by far, it's the medieval period. So that's kind of my focus and my specialties in the Crusades, as we mentioned and we talked about. And I love the medieval church because I think it's, as Warren Carroll called it, he called it the glory, that time period was the glory of Christendom. It's a period of great faith, an age of faith. The people were, you know, the whole lives of people in the medieval world was just wrapped up with the church and the liturgical calendar. And, you know, the feasts of saints was a huge role in part of people's lives. And that's the age when you have these great cathedrals, magnificent cathedrals that are still in Europe that were created because people, you know, I mean, they would spend centuries even building these magnificent buildings as a testament to their faith to Christ. And it's the time of the Crusades, you know, and so there's a lot of, you know, a lot of good faithful examples of people who have, you know, left everything behind, you know, risked everything, their life, their family, their property, their finances, everything, simply because they wanted to serve Christ and his church out of love because the Pope asked them to go and help to defend the Holy Land and to recover it. So it's an age of just really immense faith. Doesn't mean that everybody there was saints, obviously, or that everything was perfect, or, you know, there weren't great, you know, it wasn't missing all the amenities of the modern world that we have. But, you know, it really was a fascinating period of time in history. And so I love studying that period of time. And my next project will be focused on that particular period of time as well. So,
all right. So as we wind down today, Steve, where can people find your book, Timeless, A History of the Catholic Church?
Yeah, a great place for people to go is to, it's published by Our Sunday Visitor, so to go to their website, it's Our Sunday, or it's OSV Catholic Bookstore, and they do have free shipping there. It's also available on Amazon and should be available at any any other Catholic bookstore. And if people want to know more about me and my work and read some articles that I've written about various historical subjects, I do have my own website, which is just steveweidenkopf.com.
All right. And with that, that's all we have time for today. Steve, thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule and spending it with us. Any closing thoughts?
No, I just encourage people to continue to, you know, grow in their love for Christ and the Church, and specifically to take the time to study our church history, because it really is our family history. And it's an amazing story of you know, the men and women who have come before us. And so take that time to study it and to go deeper in your knowledge of Christ and His Church. And thank you, Pete, for the time to talk about my book.
You're welcome. And with that, you've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger. And until next time, God bless.
Breadbox Media programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com.
CMF Curo is the country's first Catholic healthcare ministry to provide an affordable health sharing solution rooted in Catholic teaching and community. Learn more at mycatholichealthcare.com/podcast. That's mycatholichealthcare.com/podcast.